of the time to come. A dark and gloomy future. And hearing such a sermon, and if the entire sermon is just devoted to that, it actually could make the Sabbath a little bit depressing. You'd come away from Sabbath services and you'd have this depressed feeling. We don't want that. We want to come away from the service uplifted and joyful and happy. And you come away from hearing a sermon like that and it just kind of brings you down. So this type of sermon started to be on the decline. But you know, it wasn't all negative. And oftentimes a sermon like that would be given. And sometimes there was a positive side to it as well. Because a companion message would also be included in it from time to time, just to brighten it up a little bit, just to make it a little less depressing, a little more joyful, a little more something to be thankful for. Ministers would often include this companion message in their sermons on this topic. And that was the fact that God's faithful would escape the great tribulation by going to a place of safety. The church would be carried away to be sheltered in some place of God's choosing, where they would be shielded from the horrible times to come upon this world. Now, the location of this place, wherever it was, we, of course, never really claimed that we knew, but we sort of thought we knew that it was going to be this place called Petra. Or maybe it's pronounced Petra. I'm not quite sure how most people pronounce it. How many of you prefer Petra? How many of you prefer Petra? Okay, Petra wins by a narrow margin. The rest of you who didn't raise your hand don't really care, right? Philadelphia, when I gave this 2 weeks ago up there, they all voted for Petra also. So we'll go with that. But the ancient city of Petra was a location that was filled with caves and high cliffs. And the city has several buildings in it that are carved out of the rock. Maybe you've seen some of these pictures. Maybe you've even visited this place. I know some people who have been there and have seen it. And it was surmised that because of all the high cliffs and because it was kind of secluded down in this area, that in the nuclear war that would take place, all the fallout from the atomic bombs and everything would not penetrate this area, and anyone who was in there would be totally safe from all that. So it would provide protection from the results of world war. That was part of the thinking of Petra as the place of safety. Now, long before I ever heard of the church, long before I even before I started in the Catholic Church, which was from age 6 to age 14, even before then, I had heard one particular chapter in the Bible which talked about God's protection. I knew about this because it was the chapter that I heard read to me every night since as far back as I can remember. I'm talking maybe 4 or 5 years old at the time. But my mother would read this to me every night at bedtime. She would read the entire chapter. And that chapter was Psalms 91. I'm going to read that chapter to you today, not all at once. Throughout the sermon, I'll read parts of it, but we'll read the whole thing before it's over. But let's read the first 6 verses now of Psalms 91. And this was the message that I had put into my head every single night when I was very young. To the point where I think before I started school, I had memorized the entire chapter. Psalms 91, verse 1. He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in Him I will trust. Surely He shall deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the perilous pestilence. He shall cover you with His feathers, and under His wings you shall take refuge. His truth shall be your shield and buckler. You shall not be afraid of the terror by night, nor of the arrow that flies by day, nor of the pestilence that walks in the darkness, nor of the destruction that lays waste at noonday. It talks about how God will be your protector. It says he will deliver you from the snare of the fowler. Now, for those of you who don't know what a fowler is, basically it's one who catches birds in a trap or a snare. It's saying that he's going to save you from that. He's going to save you from those who would seek to trap you in something, possibly a false doctrine or a false teaching or an ungodly way of life. A buckler, you know, some of these terms are a little strange to us. A buckler is a small round shield held by a handle. Now, it talks about terrorists and those seeking to kill with weapons. From a plague that walks in darkness, an unseen killer. I think we all know what that's like. We know about plagues. We know about the unseen disease. It talks about destruction or war that lays waste, basically creating a wasteland, which, as we know, in the coming tribulation, there will be wars. There will be desolation. There will be a lot of destruction taking place, and things are just not going to look the same afterward. But we're told in this chapter in Psalms not to fear these things because God is our refuge. What about in the last days? Are the faithful going to be protected? Does the Bible indicate there will be a place of safety? Certainly this chapter in the book of Psalms seems to indicate that yes, indeed, God will provide us with a place of safety. We'll read a little more of this chapter later on. But where did we actually get the idea of the church being taken to a place of safety? Now, the main scripture indicating this was one that was revealed to John. Let's go to Revelation chapter 12. Revelation chapter 12 and verses 13 and 14. In these verses it says, "Now when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. But the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time, from the presence of the serpent." The dragon, of course, we know, is Satan. The woman represents God's church. And as time is short, and Satan knows that he doesn't have much time, he is getting very angry and very restless, and he brings persecution upon the church. But the woman, the church, that is given flight to the wilderness. And it says, for a time and times and half a time. And prophetically, that refers to a period of 3.5 years. This is the period of time that we call the Great Tribulation. And it's during this time that the church is fed away from the serpent. It says that the earth helped the woman and opened its mouth, as we see in the next couple of verses here. Verse 15, "So the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth." So the woman, the church, is being helped and being given protection from the attacks of the serpent. The serpent sends a flood, which prophetically is referring to an army. And the earth helps the woman by swallowing up the flood. And the only way I can think of that the earth would open up and swallow up an army would be with a tremendous earthquake. But that remains to be seen. Verse 17. And the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. The rest of the offspring. Who is that? They're keeping God's commandments. They have the testimony of Christ. Interesting. Satan is angry because the earth swallowed up the flood, and he pursues this remnant. This remnant who, for whatever reason, did not fly away to the wilderness to be preserved in a place of safety. Now, why is that? And we aren't told why there is still an unprotected remnant. And we're also not told who the remnant consists of. And like I said before, we've always talked about Petra as being the location where the faithful would be protected. So where did we ever get this idea? Where did we ever get the notion, first of all, of Petra being the place? And does it really make sense? And does it seem logical today that that would be the place? Well, it appears, first of all, that this area where Petra is located would escape the hand of the king of the north in the end time. Let's go back to Daniel chapter 11. In Daniel 11, verse 40, it says, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships. And he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. He shall also enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape from his hand: Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. But these three, Edom, Moab, and Ammon, are going to escape. They're not going to be affected by this attack from the king of the north as he goes through plundering all the nations. Petra is found within the Edom, Moab, Ammon area. It's right there in what we would call the land where Moab existed at one time. Now, at the time of the end, this area may have become uninhabited. It certainly seems like Moab is not going to be very populous. As you read Jeremiah 48, verse 9, let's look at that. It almost sounds like the entire country in that area is going to be fleeing at this time. Jeremiah 48, verse 9 says, give wings to Moab that she may flee and get away, for her cities shall be desolate without any to dwell in them. You know, it once seemed like the perfect place for such a gathering, for such a place to go where we could be safe from the things going on in the world. It seemed like at one time this might be the ideal place of safety. Although it maybe is not the most comfortable, it could be the most safe and secure. Isaiah chapter 16, verse 1. Isaiah 16, verse 1. It says, send the lamb to the ruler of the land, from Selah to the wilderness, to the mount of the daughter of Zion. For it shall be as a wandering bird thrown out of the nest. So shall be the daughters of Moab at the fords of the Arnon. Take counsel, execute judgment, make your shadow like the night in the middle of the day. Hide the outcasts, do not betray him who escapes. Let my outcast dwell with you, O Moab. Be a shelter to them from the face of the spoiler, for the extortioner is at an end. Devastation ceases. The oppressors are consumed out of the land. In mercy, the throne will be established, and one will sit on it in truth, in the tabernacle of David, judging and seeking justice and hastening righteousness. Obviously talking about the time of the end here, and he mentions in the very beginning this place called Selah. Selah is mentioned here. Now, what is the translation of the Hebrew word Selah? The word means rock. And if you look at Petra, it is one big rock. So Selah is the Hebrew word that means rock. Do you know what the Greek word for rock is? The Greek word for rock is Petra. So that's kind of how this place came to be focused on as the place of safety. In this verse here that I just read in Isaiah 16, who are, where it says, my outcasts? Who are the outcasts it's talking about here? Could that be God's elect who have been rejected by the world? And why is Moab being asked to shelter them? You know, so when you put all these things together, you can see why we would have considered this as possibly the place of safety. In Isaiah 33, verse 2. Isaiah chapter 33, verse 2. O Lord, be gracious to us. We have waited for you. Be their arm every morning, our salvation also in the time of trouble. At the noise of the tumult, the people shall flee. When you lift yourself up, the nations shall be scattered. So might this indicate God's people being in a safe place? Is that possible? Is that what we're talking about? Look at verse 15. He who walks righteously and speaks uprightly, he who despises the gain of oppressions, who gestures with his hands, refusing bribes, who stops his ears from hearing of bloodshed and shuts his eyes from seeing evil. He will dwell on high. His place of defense will be the fortress of rocks. Bread will be given him. His water will be sure. There's not a lot of water in Petra. It's a very dry area. And yet, it says his water will be sure. So are we talking about this fortress of rocks here, the righteous being defended there? I have to admit that Petra would fit the description. But then again, so would many other places. There are many other places throughout the Middle East or in other countries, even in this country, that would fit the description, at least physically. So, of course, you know, is it possible we were just reading Petra into all of this, into these verses, because we were trying to make Petra fit into these verses? None of them conclusively prove that Petra is the place of safety. But that's how we got there. That's how we arrived at that conclusion many years ago. So let's ask the question, where and when will the faithful be taken to a place of safety? Will they be taken? And if so, where and when? Will God's people all be taken physically to a faraway place? Now, earlier we saw how the church was given the wings of an eagle and how she would be taken to her place in the wilderness. Now, that word wilderness implies a faraway, kind of a middle of nowhere type of place. And being taken is compared to what happened to the people in the times of Noah and the times of Lot. Let's go to Luke chapter 17. And we'll see the connection here. In Luke 17, verse 26. It says, and as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be also in the days of the Son of Man. They ate, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and the flood came and destroyed them all. Likewise, as it was also in the days of Lot, They ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. But in the day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even so it will be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. So the end time is likened here to the time of Noah and the time of Lot. These two men were taken to safety from their home. Noah being preserved on a huge ship that he built at God's instruction, and Lot being saved by being taken by two angelic beings from his home out away from the city where the destruction was going to take place. In both cases, their families were taken with them. Both of these men and their families would have died had they not been taken to a place that was safe from the destruction. In verse 34. Luke 17, verse 34. I tell you, in that night there will be two in one bed. One will be taken, the other will be left. Two will be grinding together, the one will be taken, the other left. Two will be in the field, one will be taken, and the other left. The fact that it says that not everyone will be taken, that's what's implied here. It says one will be taken, one will be left. It tells us not everyone will be taken. So what determines who is taken to a place of safety and who isn't? What determines who goes and who doesn't go? Well, a little bit later on, I'm going to give you one possible determining factor that I want you to see and understand. Another big question is, where will the elect be taken? Where is this place of safety going to be? And in verse 37, same chapter, it says, and they answered and said to him, where, Lord? So he said to them, wherever the body is, there the eagles will be gathered together. So not exactly a actual coordinates of the place of safety, but a generalization here that wherever the body is, there the eagles will be gathered together. What does that mean? You know, if God revealed the exact location of the place of safety, if God told us it's going to be in Petra or it's going to be in Grand Canyon or whatever, you know, some place with rocks, some place that's a lot of open space. If God told us where it was, what do you think would happen? We would have people camping out there today, waiting, wanting to make sure that they were the first in because they wanted to escape. So God doesn't tell us exactly where it is. So we aren't told. But what we are told is wherever the body is, there the eagles will be gathered. What is the body? Well, the church is also known as the body of Christ. Wherever the church is, there the eagles or the individual members of the church will be gathered. So where is the place of safety going to be? Wherever the church goes and all of the members go there. You know, you'll know that's the place because the entire church is going to go there. When the time is right, God will make the location or locations, if there's more than one, be known. He'll tell us when we need to know. But then the question comes up, is it possible that God's faithful could just be protected wherever they happen to be? You know, can God put a shield around them? And each one of us has our own private little place of safety. Could these scriptures be referring to this? This question was asked many times. Could God protect us in our own homes? Could he shield us that way? You know, you don't have to ask, can God protect you in your home? God can protect you anywhere he wants to protect you. You know, he is capable of doing anything. But I want to go back to Psalms 91 and read the next section of it, because I think it'll bring some light to this. Psalms 91, verse 7. In Psalms 91, verse 7, it says, 1,000 may fall at your side, and 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not come near you. Only with your eyes you shall look and see the reward of the wicked. If you read this, it makes you feel like death and destruction can be right at your side. It can be right alongside of you wherever you are. But God will keep you safe while you watch the evil people fall all around you. So that kind of says he can protect you wherever you happen to be. Verse 9. Because you have made the Lord, who is my refuge, even the Most High, your dwelling place, no evil shall befall you, nor any plague come near your dwelling. Plagues will not come anywhere near your home. You know, where you live, there won't be any plagues coming near you. There won't be any destruction that affects you. Is that what it's saying? But where is home? Where is home? Look what it says in here in verse 9. We just read it. Because you have made the Lord, who is my refuge, even the Most High, your dwelling place. You have caused your abode to be with God the Father, the Most High, and Jesus Christ. And what does it say back in verse 1? Go back to verse 1 of that same chapter. Psalms 91, verse 1. I read it in the beginning. It says, he who dwells in the secret place of the Most High. He who dwells with God. He who has God in his life. He who has this close contact with God. He is living in the shadow of the Most High. And if you live under God's shadow, then it all makes sense. Verse 11, Psalms 91, verse 11. For he shall give his angels charge over you to keep you in all your ways. In their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone. You shall tread upon the lion and the cobra, the young lion and the serpent you shall trample underfoot. God is your refuge. The plague will avoid your premises if you are living under his shadow. Now, I want to cover, before I go any further, a couple of misconceptions about the place of safety and the time of the Great Tribulation. There are some people who believe, and these are not people in God's church, but people in other churches in the world, that the Great Tribulation will last for 7 years. Not 3.5 years, as the Bible says, but there are people who believe the tribulation is something that will last 7 years. Where did that idea come from? Okay, I'm going to show you. The idea of 7 years of tribulation is mainly associated with a belief in a rapture, which is a concept that a lot of churches teach that has no basis in the Bible. And there's too much to cover there in one sermon. I'll probably give a sermon on that sometime in the future, but I'm not going to go into it today. But suffice it to say that this belief has to do with the 70 weeks prophecy in the book of Daniel, in chapter 9 to be specific. The 70th week in the 70 weeks prophecy represents 7 years, which end with the return of Jesus Christ. And so that week, that last week, which of course is 7 days and a day represents a year, leads to the conclusion that the tribulation, this final week, will last for 7 years. But those 7 years are not continuous years, as I will show you. Now, the previous 69 weeks represent the previous 483 years. 69 times 7 7, the number of days in a week, 69 times 7 is 483. So in Daniel chapter 9, verse 25, I know I should have told you to bring your calculators. I'll make it simple, don't worry. Daniel 9, 25. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again and the wall, even in troublesome times. Now it says 7 weeks and 62 weeks. That's a total of 69 weeks. So there is a period of 69 weeks, which is 69 times 7, 483 years, from, and it gives you the starting point of that time period, from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince. So it is told here how many years it would take from the time that the command would go forth to rebuild Jerusalem until the time of Jesus Christ, 483 years. Well, the command to restore Jerusalem was given in 457 BC. And then that was when the captivity was ending, the Jews were going or returning back to Jerusalem and beginning to rebuild. 457 BC. If you go 483 years from that point, it brings you to 27 AD. The year that Christ's earthly ministry began, to the very day, 483 years. It was exact. It was right on target. Christ came when he was supposed to come, and his ministry began. At that time, in 27 AD, Christ was baptized. He was taken to the wilderness, tempted by Satan. And at that point, he overcame Satan and he literally dethroned him as the king of this world, the god of this world, actually. And he qualified to replace him as king over the entire earth, of which he will assume that throne at the appointed time. And so all that happened back in 27 AD. That 70th week began at that point. And Christ died in 31 AD, exactly 3.5 years after his ministry began. So the first 3.5 years have already happened. They're already behind us. There's not 7 years of tribulation. 3.5 years were represented by the 3.5 years he was here on the earth raising up his church. And then there are 3.5 years left. Christ's ministry was the first half of the final 7 years. And then the last 3.5 years before he returns will be the conclusion of it. God's people will be in a place of protection for that 3.5 years. This coincides with the Great Tribulation, which we read in Revelation 12 about a time and times and half a time. It's likely that God's people, once they're in this place of protection, will be undergoing some final training, because after all, they're going to be kings and priests on the earth at the resurrection when they receive those spirit bodies, those eternal bodies. They're going to have a position of rulership in the world, and they're going to be trained for that. And so this 3.5 period will then conclude the final 7 years. But the tribulation itself is only the last 3.5 years of that 7-year period, the first 3.5 years having already taken place. So that's one misconception about the place of safety. And there's another one. Is the place of safety available to only 144,000 people? And that's kind of an easy one to answer. A lot of people misread Revelation. They get mixed up in the times and in the time sequence and the events that take place. Go to Revelation chapter 7 and verse 2. Revelation chapter 7, verse 2. Then I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God. And he cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea, saying, "Do not harm the earth, the sea, or the trees till we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads." And I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel were sealed. And it goes on to talk about, 12,000 from this tribe and 12,000 from this tribe. And each tribe has 12,000 who are going to be sealed from that individual tribe. Now, in years past, some people have misunderstood the sealing of the 144,000. These are not the same as those who would go to a place of safety, because this event occurs at a totally different time. This event occurs just prior to what we call the day of the Lord, the day of God's wrath, the final year of that 3.5-year period called the Great Tribulation. And so this event occurs 2.5 years later. Now, the book of Revelation doesn't actually say that the day of the Lord lasts for 1 year, but Isaiah kind of hints toward that. And we read that in Isaiah 34, verse 8. And it talks about here, the final seven trumpet plagues will all occur during that final year leading up to the return of Christ. In Isaiah 34, verse 8, it says, "For it is the day of the Lord's vengeance, the year of recompense for the cause of Zion." It is the day of the Lord. It is that day of his wrath, his vengeance, the year of recompense. So he calls it literally a year. Again, the day for a year principle is here, as we see in prophecy in so many places. And so this is what's happening here. The day of God's wrath, the final year before Christ returns. And God's people existing at that time are all to be sealed before his wrath begins. And every one of God's people will be protected from the wrath of God. They weren't all protected necessarily from Satan's wrath that's been already going on for 2.5 years. But now, this final year of God's wrath, all of God's people will be protected from it. For the previous 2.5 years, God's elect have been in a place of safety. But now this is the rest of God's people. God's people are all to be sealed before his wrath, and that includes the 144,000 from Israel, and it also includes a great multitude. Now for that, I want to turn back to Revelation 7 again, and this time I want to read verses 9 and 10. Revelation 7, verse 9. "After these things I looked," this is after the 144,000 are sealed, "I looked and behold a great multitude which no one could number, of all nations, tribes, peoples, and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes with palm branches in their hands, and crying out with a loud voice, saying, 'Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb.'" And so we see the 144,000 and this great multitude joining them. The great multitude is from all the Gentile nations. They all seem to have been converted during the Great Tribulation time. And perhaps this was the result of the work of the two witnesses who have been preaching for those years, those previous 2.5 years, and have another year to go yet. And so perhaps it's because of the work that they've been doing. But once they are sealed, then the seven trumpet plagues can begin. But remember, God's elect have already been in a place of safety for 2.5 years before that. So their protection is not the same as of the 144,000. Neither is it connected to the great innumerable multitude, because they are only sealed for that one final year. But these two events are separate and occur 2.5 years apart. And so the belief that 144,000 are all that's going to the place of safety, that's mixing two different events here, and it's mixing up the facts. There is so much we've been shown about these end time events, but there is still a lot that has not been revealed yet. And some details won't be revealed until we get there. But there are many things we don't really need to know. And that's good, because if we knew too much, it could be to our detriment. It could be not good for us, not wise for us to know too much too soon. Like, where is the place of safety? Like I said, everybody would be camping out there, and that would create a lot of problems for them and for other people as well. But it could be not a good thing for us to know too much too soon. So where should our focus be concerning the place of safety? Where should we be concentrating on? How do we prepare for this? Well, let's ask the question, at Christ's return, what's he going to be looking for in his people? What's he going to be trying to determine about his people? You know, the end time is going to be so horrible, it's going to be very difficult to survive in it. But I don't think that when Christ returns, he's going to be looking to evaluate how good our survival skills were, to see how well we did in preparing for and physically escaping the tribulation. That's not what he's looking for. Notice in Luke chapter 18, verse 7. Luke chapter 18, verse 7. It says, "And shall God not avenge his own elect, who cry out day and night to him, though he bears long with them? I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on the earth?" That's what he's going to be looking for. He's not going to want to see how well we did at escaping and surviving through the tribulation. He's going to want to see, are we people of faith? That's what he's actually concerned about, our faith. Do we need to know how to prepare to live in a bleak world? You know, we don't know what challenges we're going to face, so how can we prepare? We don't know what it's going to be like. We can surmise things, but we don't really know how it's going to be. So how do we know how to prepare? You know, the basic infrastructure that we take for granted today might be gone. And we might not have the modern conveniences we have today. There might be no electric. You know, after all the wars take place and everything is destroyed, you know, the desolation that we read about, is there going to be an electric grid still standing? Will there be an internet? Oh no, how are we going to live without the internet? Or telephone service? Yeah, maybe that one's a good thing. Maybe we can get a little rest from the phone. Will we be able to obtain gasoline to drive places? You know, we might not be able to drive anywhere. Transportation might be at a standstill. We might not be able to go any place on our own power. Everything we depend on today may cease to exist. We talk about building up a retirement fund, building up your 401k, building up all of these different accounts, savings accounts, whatever. You know, the value of your investments might approach zero. You see, it doesn't take much in the world for the stock market to come down and all of a sudden you don't have as much invested as you used to. Your livelihood, your income might disappear. Look in just the last year and a half, how many people lost their jobs because of this pandemic. How many people just didn't have a place to go to work. And they were told not to go out of their homes, not to go anyplace, not to visit with people, not to congregate with people. We don't know what's going to happen. We didn't know that was going to happen. And look how much that brought us down. Look how much the value of our investments dropped in that period of time. It's coming back up now. But it went down. It took a big dip in the beginning. And when this really heavy stuff starts, when the tribulation begins, it's going to come down very quickly. And so all of this might disappear. You may be instructed to go to a place of safety. You don't know how you're going to get there. You don't know what means will be available to get there. And there are some things like your home, your car, your physical belongings, some things that you may just have to leave behind and walk away from completely. Your bank account might become totally useless as the economy fails, and perhaps even the government falls. You think you're relying on that Social Security check that's guaranteed for the rest of your life? Don't count on it, because when the government falls, there is no more Social Security. We might even have to leave some family members behind. If some of our family is not in the church, they don't understand these things and don't listen to you when you talk about them. You know, you might have to leave them behind. Matthew 10, verse 37. What's more important to you? Matthew 10, 37. It says, "He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me." We may be required to walk away with absolutely nothing, which is very similar to what the Israelites did when they left Egypt. They only took their animals and the things that they plundered from the Egyptians, and that's all they carried out with them. Hopefully we won't become complainers like they did once they were on their way to their place of safety. You will not be able to prepare for your physical future. You won't be able to know what you might need to prepare for it. Just like Israel in the wilderness, we will have to depend entirely upon God. We will need great faith, and that's where our focus needs to be. These are things we needn't worry about. We don't have to get all excited about it and all fearful if we have faith. If you have faith, it'll be a breeze because you know God's going to take care of these things. But if you're worried about what am I going to do, how am I going to survive, then it's going to be a tough time for you. But we don't need to worry as long as we have faith. Will you be concerned how to save your life? Matthew 10, 39, the very next verse. It says, "He who finds his life will lose it, and he who loses his life for my sake will find it." And it might just be that all the things you're doing to try and survive are the things that are going to end up being your demise. And if you don't worry about those things, that might be what saves you. Matthew 16, verse 24. Then Jesus said to his disciples, "If anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it." To what length will you go to preserve your life? Trying to take with you whatever you think you're going to need, those physical things that you feel the need to carry with you might end up being your downfall. In Hebrews 11, verse 6, a very familiar scripture, it says, "Without faith it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him." We can't be pleasing to God without faith. And we will never survive in the place of safety without faith. Now, is it true that the Bible says we should always be praying that we'll be able to escape to a place of safety? Is that what the Bible says? Let me show you where that's written, and let's see if that's what it means. In Luke chapter 21, verse 34. Luke 21, verse 34 says, "But take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and cares of this life, and that day come on you unexpectedly. For it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the whole earth." And then in verse 36 it says, "Watch therefore and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass, and to stand before the Son of Man." Is that what this is saying? That we should pray that we're worthy to escape? Or is it saying something else? Essentially, we're being told to do two things in this verse. We're being told to watch, and we're being told to pray always. What if we reverse the order of those two and reread that scripture? Let's read that verse again and just switch the order of those two things that we're being told to do. Verse 36 would then say, "Pray always and watch that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass." Takes on a little different tone, doesn't it? Listen to it again. "Pray always and watch that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things which will come to pass." Are we to pray that we'll be worthy to escape? Or do we become worthy to escape because we're watching and praying? A simple comma after the phrase "pray always" gives it new meaning. Watch therefore, comma, and pray always, comma, that you may be counted worthy. In other words, you will be counted worthy if you are watching and if you are praying. Is it really saying that we should pray that we could escape? I don't think it's meaning that exactly. Watching and praying is how we prepare. Matthew 24, verse 42. Matthew 24, 42 says, "Watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known the hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect." Be ready. How do you be ready? How can you be ready? You can be ready because you have faith that God's going to take care of it. And who does God elevate to a safe place? Now, who is God going to elevate to this place of protection? Let's go to Job chapter 5, verse 11. Job chapter 5, verse 11. "He sets on high those who are lowly, and those who mourn are lifted to safety." And then go down to verse 17. "Behold, happy is the man whom God corrects. Therefore, do not despise the chastening of the Almighty. For he bruises, but he binds up. He wounds, but his hands make whole. He shall deliver you in six troubles. Yes, in seven, no evil shall touch you. In famine, he shall redeem you from death, and in war, from the power of the sword. You shall be hidden from the scourge of the tongue, and you shall not be afraid of destruction when it comes." God takes care of his people. And all we have to do is have faith in that. We don't have to worry about how to prepare. We don't have to be trying to figure out how can I be worthy to escape. Well, you're worthy to escape when you're praying and watching and having faith. Now, does it seem a little bit selfish to you, perhaps, to be praying that you be counted worthy? Do you feel like maybe you're being a little selfish when you view it that way? To pray that you'll be counted worthy. Asking for deliverance. Well, asking for deliverance is not wrong, with one stipulation. And that stipulation is, are we willing to accept God's will over our own? Because sometimes we forget that God's will is more important. And if we do pray that way, if we do ask for deliverance, we're only following Christ's example. Because he prayed for deliverance in Matthew 26:39. He asked for deliverance on the night before he died. Matthew 26:39. He went a little farther and fell on his face and prayed, saying, O my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. He was praying for deliverance from what he was about to go through. But then he qualified it with the rest of the statement. He says, nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. So it's not wrong to ask for deliverance. And if you want to do that, if you want to pray that you'll be accounted worthy, then do so. But that's the same as praying, God, give me the faith. Help me to have the faith to get through this terrible time. In fact, Christ actually prayed this prayer 3 times about escape. So it's not wrong. It's not selfish to pray that way, but we need to be concentrating on faith. That's the most important thing. So what is the most important thing to remember regarding the place of safety? Be ready. How do we get ready? Not by storing up physical goods for the trip. Because remember, you can't provide what you'll need. You don't know what you'll need, and you don't know what to provide. But it's not by storing up physical goods. It's not by storing up a high bank account. Remember that you don't know what you will need. But be spiritually ready. Forget what you might need physically. That's not important. Because if you have what you need spiritually, you won't need anything physically. Watch and pray always and be increased in faith. And this could be the determining factor in who goes to the place of safety and who doesn't. The determining factor could be your faith. You know, one will be taken, one will be left. Perhaps this is what it's referring to. The place of safety and the great tribulation are not things that we need to fear. There's a lot we don't know about them, and that's good. It's good that we don't know. Too much information could possibly weaken our faith. But trust God, make your faith strong. That's how we prepare. Concentrate on the fact that the kingdom of God is near. You know, the bad stuff has to happen, but then the kingdom is right behind it. That's the good stuff. That's the best news we could hope to ever hear, is that God's kingdom was here. Just be prepared for the end. Be prepared spiritually. Don't worry about physically. Be prepared to walk away from everything you own if need be. Because in the end, it's all going to become worthless anyway. I want to conclude with reading the rest of Psalms 91. Verses 14 through 16. Because he has set his love upon me, therefore I will deliver him. I will set him on high because he has known my name. He shall call upon me and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him. With long life, I will satisfy him and show him my salvation. That's the goal. Keep that in mind. Salvation is the end of it. That's the good news. We don't need to worry about anything else.